This is David Rovics, and you are tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., Melbourne, Australia. Step three is finding there's a tactic when everyone believes it could be true. That if all the people work collectively, there just might be something we can do, and everything can change.
You are listening to the Climate Action Show on the Community Broadcast Network. We acknowledge and pay respect to the people of the Woiwurrung and Boonwurrung language groups of the Eastern Kulin Nations, on whose unceded lands the 3CR studios stand, respectfully acknowledging their ancestors and elders, past, present, and emerging. We also acknowledge the traditional custodians and the ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia, where our broadcast reaches. Hi everyone, and thank you so, so much for tuning in to another episode of the Climate Action Show. We won't waste much time on introductions today. We've got a very packed show today, which is very exciting. Today we'll be focusing a lot of our time on climate disinformation and misinformation. So upcoming, we've got an interview that Rosie did with Christian Downey, who co-authored the book Climate Obstruction, A Global Assessment, which was a new book from Brown University's Global Climate Social Science Network, looking into what obstructions have made climate action just so difficult. And then later on after that, we have an interview with Philip Newell from the Climate Action Against Disinformation Group, further talking about climate action when it comes to disinformation and misinformation online. After that, we'll be talking about an article, an opinion piece, me and Shay, about changing how we consume climate action apart from news and science, looking at it a different way. But for now, first up, we have an update on the public housing towers from Rosie, who spends a lot of her time down at the pickets and rallies. So back in August, we interviewed Steve Minton, Dr. Kate Shaw, and Kat McLeod about the demolition of the 44 public housing towers. And here today, we have an update on what's going down at the Flemington Towers. So take a little listen.
12 Holland Court in Flemington, where there's a number of public housing towers, which I believe are about to be demolished. And there's a big group of people outside the front with various banners. And can I just ask you, sir, why are you here? Can you tell me what's going on here?
Well, we're opposed to the demolition of the 44 public housing towers, which will displace 10,000 of society's most sort of desperate people during a housing crisis. We think this is unethical. We think it's robbing people of the dignity they should have of just being able to have their own home. And we're encouraging the community to support us by honking as they drive past in their cars with our very colourful signs and banners.
Okay, great. Thank you. Now, but isn't Housing Victoria saying that these housing towers need to be knocked down because they're not in a fit state for habitation? And aren't they building new public housing for all these people?
Well, first of all, I'm sure they've got all the documentation. They've got 150 documents saying that they need to be knocked down, which they haven't shown to the public because no doubt they've fallen down the back of a cupboard or something and can't get them. So that happens. That's sort of an easy mistake to make. But they haven't looked at how many options they are. They can clearly, these buildings can be refurnished. The good people at office have given reports how the buildings can be sort of fixed up. Many, many options rather than just sort of knocking them down and displacing 10,000 people.
Oh, thank you. And they're not really revealing any of the work they've done to research why they need to be knocked down?
No, 150 documents. And our government, and if they need to be knocked down, okay, if they've done the research, but why not show us? So I don't want to be conspiratorial. Seems a little bit suspicious. And I'm sure it's not some part of some grand privatisation plan to replace all of public housing with more private social housing.
Surely not.
I'm sure not. Sorry. You don't want to hear crazy conspiratorials.
No,
the street today.
No. Yes. Well, thank you very much for talking to me.
It's a pleasure.
really just rabble with banners, or are you here for a reason?
Well, we're here because we don't want to see these towers knocked down. They've been here for 50 years. They're made of solid iron and concrete. Don't believe the hype that there's something wrong with these towers. They've been here. They're not falling down anytime soon. And if there is some evidence, why aren't they showing us the evidence? Mm. So, okay, we think, well, we don't want to see that. Not one of these bricks here in this wall is going to be moved off this site. Or my name is Captain James Kangaroo. And we are going to be here as long as it takes. We're making sure not only is this building not going to be knocked down, it's going to be refurbished into a beautiful, really a great monument to the campaign that saved it. What we need is more people to come down and join us every morning of a weekday from 7 o'clock a.m. to 9 o'clock a.m. And we're having so much fun down here. We're painting banners, we're talking to everyone, getting to know everyone. It's like a party every morning.
And there's a very lot of traffic noise with all the tooting that's going on. What's that all about?
Well, there's a sign saying, honk to save our homes, honk to save the towers. And we're getting a lot of thumbs up. Buckets of money are being donated to the campaign. People are just spontaneously throwing us $50, $100 notes. We have to jump pretty high to catch them because there's another mate, I think, a fellow who's hanging around. He's got a black hat. I think we just heard from him. He seems to grab that cash before we can get our hands on it. But nevertheless, we're just saying action speaks louder than words, everybody. Come on down every day we're here, 7 to 9, and then afternoon, 4:30 to 6:30, 12 Holland Court, Flemington. You can't miss it. Just near Newmarket Station on the Craigieburn line, or just near Flemington Bridge Station on the Upfield line.
Or the number 57 tram, stop 24.
Can't miss it. Come on down, all you people out there in listening land of 3CR. We need you down here to Monday morning, 7 o'clock sharp.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Okay, now these good folk that I've been talking to who've just been at the Solidarity honking fest and banner waving to support the people in the public housing towers at 12 Holland Court in Flemington. Now we're here at a cafe, at our favourite cafe actually, having a bit of a debrief. And the lovely Charlotte, who works in the cafe, has just come out to see what we're up to. And she has just heard about 3CR and she's just subscribed. So say, Charlotte, thank you so much for your generous subscription to 3CR. So now that you know about what's happening with the public towers, although you already knew quite a bit about it, what do you think about it?
I think it's stepped back in the wrong direction for equality and humanitarian rights. I think people should be able to get housing in an easier and more accessible way that doesn't make them feel, I don't know, I feel like that doesn't make them feel disheartened. I feel like when you go through so many processes to apply for this public housing and then you see they're all getting knocked down and there's not as many available, it just makes people feel like they have less hope. And I feel like it brings people hope to see others fighting for their cause and fighting for their right to have, you know, a comfortable home, somewhere to go after a really long day. I just think it's so important. So yeah, keep doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you. That is really important. And you sound like a very decent person. Perhaps you should go and work for Housing Victoria and try to put some of your decency
and common sense
and care for humanity, inject some into Housing Victoria, because they are lacking it. But at the moment, I guess you're not looking for a job, because where are you working at the moment?
I'm working at Pepper Cafe on Pinot Crest in Flemington.
Yes, and they make a darned good coffee. So next time you come down to support the housing tenants in the solidarity to stop demolishing their homes, afterwards, walk up the street and there's this great coffee to be had, made by the lovely Charlotte. Thank you so much for talking to us, Charlotte.
Nice,
and I must just say, finish this saying, Charlotte is a supporter of 3CR.
Yes, we are.
Thank you.
No worries.
Okay, here's another person who's supporting public housing, and I quite like your T-shirt. What does it say?
Oh, this is Protect Native Forests. That's the other campaign I work on most of the time, but I'm also been... started working on the public housing campaign and have been on site every morning for the last, since actually the 8th of October. And the reason I'm here is one of the residents called me up in a panic, like texted me and went, "Help, I need you here," because she was stuck in a lift for an hour and was frantic and was... had tried to call all these people in Homes Victoria that her knew, you know, that are supposed to look after public housing tenants, but couldn't get anywhere, and she didn't know what was happening. So, you know, why the lifts weren't working, and she was stuck there, and she had a broken leg. So she just reached out to people she knew that were not very far away in the area, so they could help her. And so because of that, we've decided to start a support event or action every morning at 7 to 9 a.m. outside 12 Holland Court in support of residents, in solidarity to the harassment they're getting every day to move out before it's being demolished, and also to also give a... to be able to help them if they need, like if there's safety issues or if they're feeling harassed, there's someone else that can witness what's going on and help them get through the bureaucracy and the confusion that is Homes Victoria. So that's why I'm here most of the time that I can. Every weekday, Monday morning, 7 to 9 a.m., and we're also trying to be here every weekday in the afternoon, 4:30 to 6:30 p.m., different crews. And we're, you know, as you can see today, we've got lots of people from all sorts of walks of life here, and we're learning more about what's really going on behind the scenes at Homes Victoria from residents, and it's an amazing story.
Great, thank you so much, and thanks everybody for coming out and supporting such an important cause, because I don't think that many people really understand, because if they did, if they really understood what's happening to our public housing, I think everybody would be out in the streets except the 1% who are benefiting from this. Okay, thanks so much, guys.
Thanks to Duff, Captain Kangaroo, Sandra and Charlotte, who Rosie spoke with. And thank you to Rosie as well for the updates on ground at the Flemington Public Housing Towers. If you're interested in getting involved, as I'm sure you've heard numerous times just in that interview, every weekday, 7 to 9 a.m. or later in the afternoon, 4:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m., you can go on down to 12 Holland Court and get involved.
The Climate Action Team would like to thank Only Just for their financial support of this program. Only Just sources high quality, fair trade goods and gifts from artisans in over 25 developing countries, showcasing partners that use traditional skills and modern designs to create beautiful goods through ethical and sustainable practices. Discover their unique range, onlyjust.com.au, or visit their Eltham store in the Eltham Village Shopping Centre on Main Road. It's Only Just.
Have you ever wondered why, despite all the knowledge we have on climate change, there's little to no action from governments and leaders around the world? If all the information is in front of us, fossil fuel and carbon emissions cause climate change, which causes for more extreme, unpredictable and unlivable weather, why are we at a stop? Well, Climate Obstruction, a Global Assessment, a new book from the Brown University's Global Climate Social Science Network explored just that, looking into what obstructions have made climate action just so difficult. To hear more on this, Rosie interviewed co-author Christian Downey.
Hello, I'm Rosie and you're listening to 3CR Radical Radio. My guest is Christian Downey, with me to talk about climate disinformation and obstruction globally and locally.
Christian Downey is a professor in the School of Regulation and Global Governance at the Australian National University, where he is the director of the Governing Energy Transition Lab. Christian has worked as an advisor to several Australian government agencies, most recently the Department of Climate Change, Energy, Environment and Water. He's written extensively on climate change and environmental policy and politics. Christian, you've been quite involved in this topic lately. You've co-authored a new book titled Climate Obstruction, A Global Assessment, and presented a submission at the Canberra hearing of the Senate inquiry into the prevalence and impacts of misinformation and disinformation, which relates to climate change and energy. We might start with the book first. Climate Obstruction, A Global Assessment, has been described as a very important and authoritative study of organised climate policy obstruction. It was written by a collection of international scholars belonging to the Climate Social Science Network, or CSSN. Can you tell us about CSSN and how you became involved, please, Christian?
Yeah, of course. So CSSN, or the Climate Social Science Network, is an international network of climate scholars that conducts research really focused on understanding political conflict over climate change. It's headquartered at Brown University in the United States and started off with a kind of small group of researchers, but it's now got, I think it's about 800 members across 50 countries. So it's grown a lot over recent years, and of course, covering 50 countries, it's really global in scope these days. And most of the researchers that are part of the network, they're studying the politics of climate change, but they're particularly focused on who's opposing, who's blocking action on climate change, what types of organisations are they, what are their political activities, and so on. And a lot of my recent work has been focused on the political activities of business actors, the role of oil and gas industry groups and others, and the role they've played blocking climate change. And I guess that's how I got involved in the network as well.
Can I ask, is obstruction of climate action, obviously it is a big focus of the network, would you say that's the main focus?
Yeah, so scholars involved in it are focusing on a whole range of different parts of that problem, but that's one of the major focuses. So some people are focusing on the role of public relations firms, others are focusing on the role of industry lobby groups, or others are focused on, say, the agricultural industry and meat and dairy and how we might address emissions in that sector and so on. But I think one of the overarching themes is looking at who's opposing, blocking, watering down attempts to put in place ambitious climate policies.
And is this the first time scholars from so many countries have come together to address this issue?
Yes, I think it is. The book that you mentioned in the introduction, I think, really is a kind of quantum leap in our knowledge on this. We've never really had a kind of a systematic assessment that's looked globally at climate obstruction. So we have 110 authors from around the world, and it's really a terrific list of scholars from Europe, the US, parts of Asia, Australia and elsewhere that have all spent, large parts of their careers looking at climate politics. And we've looked across a range of sectors as well. We look at oil and gas, coal, utilities, agriculture, and a whole range of other organisations. So I think it really is, a quantum leap in our knowledge and our understanding for the very first time. And a lot of that work is original as well.
Okay, and what was the impetus for producing this book at this time?
That's a great question. Look, because of, the path-breaking work of climate scientists, we understand a lot about why the world is heating up and what the impacts are. There's been engineers and entrepreneurs have done so much work on improving technologies. We have most of the technologies we need to cut pollution and stabilize our climate. There's plenty of public policy pieces. We actually have most of the policy solutions. But what we've continued to confront is political failure. And I think that's one question that's puzzled me. It's puzzled lots of researchers and is very much, I think, the impetus for the book is why are governments around the world continuing to fail to put in place policies that are consistent with what the climate scientists have been warning about? Now, there's various explanations for that. There's human nature, there's some uncertainty about parts of the science, there are some technical shortcomings with some technologies. We don't dispute the plausibility of these factors in the book, but what we do argue, and this is really what motivated many of us to write it, is that there is accumulating evidence, which we pull together in the book, arguing that, you know, one of the major reasons that this transformation required to avert climate change has been so hard and been so difficult over many years is because of the attempts by various actors, various industries to obstruct it. And if we don't understand that, then we're not going to be able to overcome it. And that was very much, you know, the thinking of many of the authors when they sat down and thought about, you know, should we undertake this project?
Yeah, I guess understanding what's going on is the first step in trying to fix things. Now, you co-edited the book and are co-author of the introduction. You also co-authored Chapter 3, which is called How Coal, Utilities and Transportation Impede Climate Action. There's been quite a bit of exposure recently on the reach and influence of, as you said, big fossil fuel and the Atlas Network and the various so-called think tanks that are or have been connected with Atlas. But the chapter you co-wrote talks about the role of other major players involved in climate obstruction, including PR firms, as you said, trade associations and lobby groups. Can you tell us about that, please?
So one of the focuses in the book is all these types of organisations you just mentioned that are sometimes referred to as enablers of climate obstruction. And the reason is that PR firms, lobby groups and others are often consulted or paid by different industries to do work for them. So perhaps I'll give you one example, which is PR or public relation firms. We know there's lots of research now showing that PR and advertising firms have long been paid to craft political campaigns, for example, for the oil and gas companies to block or slow climate policies. Now, these campaigns involve more than simply running a few television ads for a corporate client. Often PR firms are running polling, they're doing focus groups, they're running media, social media campaigns. Sometimes they're undertaking astroturfing, which refers to essentially creating fake community groups to give the impression of support or opposition for an issue or policy. A lot of these campaigns have been well documented in the United States, and I've done a bit of work in that space too. We looked, for example, at how much the oil and gas industry in the US was spending on public relations. My colleagues and I looked through a decade's worth of tax records to try and answer that question. And just to give you that one example, we found that oil and gas lobby groups in the US were spending $1.5 billion Australian on public relations firms just over a decade. So huge amounts of money going into this area. And what does this money buy? Well, you know, to give you one example from the US, ahead of the US presidential elections back in 2012, I think it was, there was this group that came up called Energy Citizens. And they ran an ad campaign titled I'm an Energy Voter. You saw the ads on newspapers, television, online, featuring ordinary Americans saying, I vote for American domestic energy. And on the surface, this looked like a kind of grassroots campaign, but in reality, it was kind of classic astroturfing. The oil and gas industry had contracted a PR firm, a large one called Edelman, one of the largest in the world, to run the campaign. The people in the ads were hired actors. And when we went back and looked at our taxation data, we actually saw that the American Petroleum Institute had paid this particular PR firm, Edelman, about $180 million in contracts for those 2 years when this campaign was going on. So I think that's a good example of how PR firms are used, employed by different industries to do this type of work to oppose action on climate change.
So the book, I think, focuses mainly on North America and Europe. You talk about Energy Citizens, which is an American organisation, and there are pretty similar ones here in Australia. Are there any aspects of Chapter 3 that are particularly relevant to Australia?
Yeah, so the book is global in scope. We try and cover, you know, many, many countries around the world. You're right to say that a lot of the focus is North America and Europe, and that's simply because that's where much of the peer-reviewed work has been done. But there are plenty of studies, you know, on particular countries in Asia, in Australia and so forth, and, of course, in Latin America too. So we try and pick up as much of the research that's been done from all over the world. And there are examples of the types of things I mentioned just before in Australia. We know, for example, that many firms in the gas and coal industry in Australia have lobbied heavily against climate change for many years. Woodside, many of your listeners will have heard of, has a long history of lobbying against climate policy in Australia. In fact, Marion Wilkinson, a former ABC journalist, just wrote a terrific quarterly essay on Woodside in particular. But they're not the only ones. Utilities such as Origin Energy have lobbied against climate policy. So we know that these practices take place in Australia. And perhaps one, you know, one kind of parallel example, and particularly egregious one in recent years, was the campaign run by the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries in 2022. So this is a lobby group that represents car makers like Toyota. And what they were campaigning on was to try and weaken fuel efficiency standards. The first term of the Labor government, they tried to put in fuel efficiency standards to make our cars more efficient and clean up air pollution and ensure that we don't use as much petrol as we need to. But what we saw was there was research and leaked documents reported in the Sydney Morning Herald at the time that showed that this lobby group was lobbying government ministers, government departments. It was running a PR campaign to try and essentially delay Australia's transition to electric vehicles. And this included downplaying the potential role that EVs could play in Australia and making misleading statements about the costs of different proposed policies. So we see these types of campaigns in Australia just like we do in the US and Europe.
Those EV campaigns you're talking about, do they seem to be more successful in Australia than other countries? I think we've got one of the lowest rates of electric vehicles in this country. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer to that question. There hasn't been any systematic studies that I'm aware of that have looked at, you know, to what extent campaigns by car makers like Toyota to block policies or slow down policies promoting EVs have been more successful in Australia versus the US or Europe. But we do know those campaigns are out there. We do know they have an impact. I'm just not sure whether it's been more successful here or there. I mean, sadly, Australia's hasn't had a great track record on this. I think until the Albanese Labor government came in, Australia was, I think, the only OECD country not to have fuel efficiency standards, or at least one of the very few not to. I think it was us and Russia and a couple of others. So, Australia's been very slow on putting in place the policies that we need to advance our transition away from internal combustion engines towards electric vehicles.
Yes. And so how do you hope that publication of this global assessment will lead us closer to an end to all the lies, corruption and state influence exerted by the very powerful and very wealthy players involved?
Well, I would love that we just publish the book and that solves the problem, but I don't think it's exactly how this is going to play out. But I guess our theory of change here is that, you know, one of the issues has been that, you know, we failed to address climate change because we simply didn't understand who are the organisations that are opposing action on climate change, what were their political activities. I think, you know, we were somewhat naive about that. So part of the motivation, as I mentioned, was to really shine a light on those actors that are obstructing action on climate change, to understand their kind of political playbook. Because if you don't understand, you know, what these actors are up to, it's very hard to overcome it. We hope that this book plays that role in shining a light and showing to policymakers the types of campaigns that are being run and who's running them and how they might be better placed to address that in the future.
And hopefully the policymakers won't be too influenced by all these vested interests so that they will do something about it. Okay, so if we can return to the Senate inquiry for a moment, how did you come to be involved in that?
Yeah, so by way of background, there's this Senate committee that was set up called the Committee on Information Integrity on Climate Change and Energy. Bit of a mouthful, but essentially it's a Senate committee. It's got cross-party support. There's members from the Coalition, Labor, the Greens and independent senators. And what it's focused on is looking at how climate and energy-related misinformation and disinformation are created, how it's financed, spread, and how that's affecting Australian politics. So they've had hearings over the last few months. Typically, these Senate committees, they invite people who are doing research or have an interest in this area to put in written submissions, which we did with the Climate Social Science Network. And then they had hearings where they brought witnesses in, which we participated in as well. And I think it was a really good way to try and get before parliamentarians that, you know, are decision makers, to talk to them a little bit about, you know, what is the evidence, what we're seeing on the ground. And we weren't the only group. There was plenty of other environmental groups, NGOs, business groups and others that were talking before the senators and explaining some of the issues from their point of view. And so I think we expect that there might be more hearings early next year. And I believe that the Senate committee is due to report back to Parliament, I think, in March or April next year.
So I actually watched some of the inquiry hearings online and I did notice quite a variation in the quality and tone of responses to the Senate committee's questions. Some of the more outrageous ones, of course, have been reported in the media. But I also noticed some pretty questionable questions being put to participants by certain members of the committee. What was your experience like?
Well, these committees, I think, generally, particularly Senate Select Committees, are generally designed to be information gathering exercises. My experience was a good one. I think most of the senators on the committee, or those that were there asking questions, you know, had a real interest in understanding the problem around misinformation and disinformation, trying to understand who's doing it, who's financing it, why they're doing it. So it was a good opportunity to present our research and to put that there, and hopefully the Senate committee can take that on board and think about, you know, well, at least it can inform the report they write and hopefully the recommendations they make to the government.
Okay, great. I think that's about all. Thanks so much for joining us today, Christian. Just before we finish up, is there anything you'd like to add? Any advice about what we can do to get this information out there and try and get politicians to take some action?
Well, look, I think as much as we can is to be informed about what we're reading and, you know, what the source and evidence is of the things that we're looking at, whether it's in the news or trying to focus on reputable news sources and also being wary before you share things on social media that, you've got a good idea of where that information came from, because there is a lot of misinformation and a lot of it is being spread around on purpose. But no, I think we've covered a lot of the topic. Thanks for having me on the program and, pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much again for your time, Christian. It's been really good talking to you. Let's hope that the recommendations are acted on when they finally come through. And maybe we'll talk to you again further down the line when the recommendations actually come out.
Great. Thanks so much, Rosie. Have a lovely day.
Thanks, Christian. You too. Bye for now.
Thank you to Rosie for that interview with Christian Downey on the co-authored book, Climate Obstruction, A Global Assessment. Coming up, we've got Shay, who had interviewed Philip Newell, the communications co-chair from Climate Action Against Disinformation. But before then, we've got Green Music Australia, just a little announcement from them. They'll be running a free event next Sunday afternoon, 14th of December at Tempo Rubato in Brunswick. The Green Music Meetup will be an informal, low-key mixture of live music, climate talks and old-fashioned hanging out as part of Green Music Oz's effort to build community spaces for artists, musicians and music lovers to get together and talk about the things they care about, climate being a large centre point for this. Tim Schill, who we interviewed around about exactly a month ago, will be hosting the event. Speakers on the day will include Robin Fox, artist and co-founder of MESS, Chiara Gracia, founder of Noisy Futures, aka Girls Rock Canberra, Ilkay Reid, artist and co-founder of A Climate for Art, Damien Lawson, fossil fuel campaigner at the Sunrise Project, Luke Lodgman, head of Green Music Australia's Sustainable Music and Merch Alliance, Georgina Imbrega, owner of eco-friendly venue Tempo Rubato, and Nolani Patero, who we've also had on the show before, who's an artist and advocate working with One of One. If you're interested in attending, please RSVP at either the link in the description of this program or go to Green Music Australia on Instagram, where there will be a link in bio. Further on the spread of climate misinformation being an expansive climate obstruction, Shay will be speaking with Philip Newell, communications co-chair from Climate Action Against Disinformation, or CAD. CAD is a global coalition of over 90 organizations calling for action against the harmful spread of misinformation and disinformation on climate change and action.
Tell me a little bit about what Climate Action Against Disinformation does, who you work with, and some of your main goals.
Thanks. Hi, I am Phil Newell, the communications co-chair for Climate Action Against Disinformation, a coalition of over 120 organizations around the world now. We are working together to stop the combined efforts of Big Carbon and Big Tech, who are sabotaging climate action with disinformation and undermining democracy with hate and bigotry. You can find out more at caad.info.
You're up against some big fossil fuel companies with a lot of money to pour into ads and climate disinformation. How do you go about counteracting their influence as an organization?
So in our latest report, Deny, Deceive, Delay, Demystified, we explained that while they have the profits, we have the people power, because globally, 89% of the public wants more climate action from their leaders. But disinformation is used to make it feel like we're in the minority demanding that action and not the majority. So it's a matter of using the industry's size and its spend against it and empowering the majority of us who want climate action to act like it. So, for example, we found that ahead of the UN climate negotiations this year held in Brazil, Big Oil increased their Google ads by 2,900%, nearly 3,000% they ramped up their ads. So we can expose how they're using all that money to try and get their way, to really sort of buy friends, to try and pressure the ad industry, for example, to clean up its act. We can also use those ads to analyze what the industry is trying to do. For example, we found that on TikTok, they were seemingly looking for influencers to try and reach women and people of color and LGBTQ plus audiences. So in addition to making use of their sort of ads to use their ad spending against them, other groups are working, for example, on fossil fuel ad bans, essentially treating the fossil fuel industry like we have the tobacco industry and banning their ads outright. So The Hague, for example, has an ad ban, and it's been replicated in a few other towns. And we did some polling to find that it's broadly very popular across Europe. So it's everything from the sort of direct analyzing what they're doing to working towards those larger policy solutions so they can, you know, so we can make them stop doing it to protect people from that sort of harmful false content.
You work a lot with big tech or against big tech companies, and these kind of tech companies, they have, I guess, less regulated spaces through podcasts and social media. In what ways have you sort of met the challenges of fighting against disinformation in less governed spaces?
We've worked both with and against those big tech companies. So some of them have been relatively happy to work with us and have taken our policy suggestions on board and acted on them. For example, Pinterest was very happy. TikTok has done some real great policies. Others, obviously, like YouTube, claim they're going to self-regulate and have a policy, but then over and over, we've caught them just like basically not enforcing it. Mm-hmm. So really, it is sort of applying the same regulatory structure that we have for radio and TV to the internet now, because it is hard and it is weird to me that things that are illegal on radio, like payola of just paying somebody to play a song on the radio, you know, at least here in the U.S., very illegal, was a whole big scandal. But you can do that all the time on podcasts. Like, you don't necessarily have to say who's funding you to produce your podcasts. And, you know, that can have really stark consequences when, for example, the U.S. discovered that Russia was paying a handful of conservative podcasters some $10 million. And, you know, there was no way for their audience even to know that. So, like, regardless of the politics of it, you should be able to know who's paying for what you're consuming. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we've analyzed the podcasts in some ways to see how those fossil fuel sponsored podcasters are really towing the company lines and echoing that sort of disinformation we've seen pushed from the top down. But ultimately, you know, we should treat internet broadcasters, to hold them to a similar standard that we hold radio and TV broadcasters. Mm-hmm.
And I know some of your research has shown that right-wing content creators are receiving sort of more sponsorship from companies to promote climate misinformation. How would you suggest we go about reaching audiences in these kind of echo chambers with correct and transparent information?
So part of it is they already are sort of being hit with that information. They're just also getting the disinformation, and that gives them permission to really warp how they then think about and interpret things. So when you look at conspiracy theories, that idea, it sort of changes how you then interpret new incoming information, and then it all gets sort of put through that conspiracy theory lens. So the audience is already listening to those fossil-backed podcasts, the ones who are really bought in and loving it to the extent that they are. They're probably going to filter any other new information through that same conspiracy filter, and where, you know, evidence against a conspiracy becomes evidence that supports it, right? So there's not really a magic set of words or phrases that can snap somebody out of that kind of denial, which is why we use the phrase denial. Mm-hmm. Instead, they sort of have to want to change first, which generally means being on the receiving end of some social consequences for what is really at its core socially unacceptable behavior of lying. Mm-hmm. Right? Disinformation is essentially about lies told for money or political purposes, but it's lying, and like lying's not okay. And so they have to have they have to have some consequences for buying into that, for spouting that, for repeating that in public places. And then maybe they'll have that like, oh, that actually, that doesn't feel good, right? It feels good when you're alone and you have nobody else and you're, you know, in your room listening to it. But then when you repeat that out at a party or whatever, and everybody like looks at you funny and it kills the conversation, like that's maybe a signal to you that like, oh, that's not socially acceptable behavior. And so that's the real hard part is creating those kind of consequences and making people want to stop consuming what sort of reaffirms their biases and makes them feel good with their ego. So that's part of it, is creating consequences for that. Once that happens, then there's still not really the mass media way to confront that, to change somebody's mind. You don't change somebody's mind via an ad or mass media campaign, right? It needs to be sort of a one-on-one, a personal conversation or a relationship with somebody that they trust and that they can be vulnerable with and admit that they were wrong and admit that they had some kind of feelings one which way or whatever it is, because it's really, we're not rational beings who make informed decisions based on information. We are social creatures who make emotional decisions based on what we feel like is normal and comfortable for us. And so creating the sort of comfortable space for them in private to have those conversations is, I think, how we have seen at least other hard conversions happen, whereas there's not really a perfect message you can put on a billboard and drag somebody out of the rabbit hole. Like, that's a hole they have to walk to climb out of. So that's a really, really hard thing to do. I would much prefer we just turn off the disinfo tap in the first place, because that's what's poisoning the information environment. And so, preventing harm is always more effective than trying to patch up the wound afterwards, which is why CAD works for those sort of structural and systemic solutions, the policy solutions to turn off the tap, as opposed to trying to cure the poison afterwards.
Are there any sort of strategies that you implement that aren't so much turning off the tap, but are also sort of creating these spaces for people to engage personally and have social consequences?
Yes, though that is also very local. And so that's really more what various member organizations are doing with their communications and their messaging and their local sort of community building projects. Mm-hmm. Because really, like, there is a lot of money that gets spent on putting more good information out there, and like, that's great and good for people who want that good information, but that's not going to change it for the people who don't want good information, people who are enjoying the lies. And it's also not going to change the fact that a bunch of those social media platforms aren't a fair level playing field. The deck is stacked, so to speak. So Facebook and Instagram, for example, reporting over the years has revealed that they amplify climate disinformation because it's run by a climate denier, Jill Kaplan, who's a Republican operative who denied climate change being a problem while working in the Bush White House and then worked at Facebook. So it's a pretty clear line. The research and reporting has shown that Elon Musk has turned ex-Twitter into a right-wing propaganda and hate and disinformation machine. And it is, it's not subtle, these kind of changes. And so if it's not a level playing field, I think it doesn't make sense to treat it as if it were and keep trying to do that keep trying to win that rigged game. I feel like leaders should lead their constituents to other safer, more neutral, less biased platforms, as well as also investing in information infrastructure to match the fossil fuel industry spending on all forms of podcast studios and all that kind of thing. But really, even better is leading people offline, sort of back into the real world, and that like logging off is an option. And it's a lot harder to deceive someone with digital advertising if they're not on their phone all day. And so rebuilding that real local community, rebuilding public spaces where we can actually congregate without being subjected to ads or having to buy something. A lot of this looks like sort of rebuilding what deregulation and sort of digital addictions have changed for us in the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to sort of move the conversation a bit to AI now in climate information misinformation. Can you run me through some of the sort of AI obstacles that CAD has been faced with and how that's shifted in the past year or so with the growth of AI?
Yeah, so on top of the energy costs and the water costs, which are problematic enough to justify just turning it off, the generative AI is really bad inherently for information integrity, in that they're functionally a plagiarism machine. So not only is stealing from artists and humans, but in doing so, it's mixing in a way we can never know reliable sources with biased sources, and real news with fake news, and sarcasm with sincerity. And so it obscures what should be a relatively transparent chain of claims, and it makes it impossible to track those sources to find out where a claim originated. And that's the sort of context that's really vital to be fully informed, especially online, when you know anybody can go online and say anything. And so in a newspaper, you can see, oh, this person said this quote, right? In a story online, you could maybe see the link that goes straight to the peer-reviewed study that has, you know, every sentence basically links out or cites out to another source for that claim, right? The generative AI text is the opposite. It doesn't give you those sort of things. It gives you sources that, it gives you text that might appear like sources, but maybe that's a real source, a copy paste. Maybe it's one it just made up, right? So that it just, you know, an autocorrect with a mind of its own is not a mind of its own. It's just a copy paste machine. So generative AI text alone, like, that's bad for the information integrity environment in that it launders unreliable sources in with reliable ones. On climate disinformation specifically, one of the first things we started seeing with generative AI was the production of illustrations for disinformation. So to illustrate claims that were purely false and all made up, like that offshore wind was somehow killing whales, they generated pictures of dead whales around offshore wind turbines. Right, where there's no actual evidence that they could use, they can now cheaply, with basically no cost, manufacture a very real looking image to go along with it. More recently, ahead of the UN negotiations in Brazil this year, we also found people sharing an AI generated video of flooding supposedly happening in the town where the event was taking place, as part of the campaign to say that, like, Brazil wasn't ready. And every year, part of the sort of the political opposition to these things try and portray them as a disaster. And so this was one of the ways, was with a video claiming that there was all sorts of flooding in the city, but like the reporter was made up, and the footage, like, it was all AI generated. And really, now that it looks real, it makes it so much harder to tell. And like, people shouldn't be responsible for having to divine the exact source of everything they see, right? There should be some level of trust and safety that what we're being exposed to isn't harmful lies. So while illustrating the sort of boring blog posts with evocative images or chasing clicks and attention with AI-generated videos of things like floods, like, that's bad. Even worse is we're now seeing the flooding of policymakers with AI-generated disinfo and spam. We've seen that in Canada, where they have sent local legislators form sort of emails, but AI-generated comments to make it look like there's a lot of public outrage when there wasn't. They had to use AI to generate what seemed like public outrage. It also has happened in Australia with the inquiry into disinformation at the Senate level, received a bunch of what appeared to be AI-generated disinformation comments. So while traditionally industry front groups have had to create the illusion of public support by, like, forging signatures on letters, which is something they've been caught doing, now even the little local bit players, the small, relatively unfunded actors, can also just automate that sort of lobbying to make policymakers feel like climate action isn't popular, when really it is with their constituents sort of all over the world.
There's sort of been a shift in how climate denial was a big part of spreading, or a big part of fighting against climate activism. But now it sort of seems that a lot of people believe in climate change. So the strategy of fighting against climate activism is putting the attention towards climate change solutions being harmful and ineffective. Are there any other shifts that you sort of maybe anticipate for the future when that approach fails? Have you seen some trends emerging?
Yeah, absolutely. So the climate denial has always been this shifting blob of whatever excuse is most convenient at the moment. And so if policy is on the table, it'll be about policy. And if it's not, then it'll be to try to erode the science. But as far as sort of what's new, what I've been seeing over the past few years, the real narrative shift has been away from these groups and these fossil fuel funded groups, has been in stirring that one-sided culture war. So here in the U.S., we found that some 80% of 45 major anti-trans groups have gotten fossil fuel funding. So they've manufactured this culture war as a way to recruit new followers and tap into that manosphere, because, again, climate denial is not popular, but being a hateful bully online sure seems to be. So that really seems to be where they are going, is using anti-trans hate and bigotry as that sort of onboard to get people into that whole conspiracy conservative worldview where the elites are lying to you, even though, you know, you're voting for an elite billionaire. and watching elite billionaire owned and operated news and et cetera, you know, the experts are lying to you. COVID was manufactured in a lab, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a way to tap into that larger conspiracy mindset that is more palatable to the mainstream and for the centrist kind of voices that they're trying, that they need some credibility with to maintain political power.
And my last question is, how do you personally stay sort of grounded and connected to reality and truth when so much of your work consists of having to exist in such a sea of disinformation and antagonism? How do you find community and support?
Yeah, part of what keeps me on track is just knowing that the disinformation is used like an illusion. It's a magic trick that the polluters and petrostates use to use money to buy the appearance of popularity, right? So they have to use sponsored podcast propagandists like Shapiro or advertorials to get into the New York Times or ads to be popular on TikTok. And then they couple that with those political campaign contributions and lobbying. And so they have to use those deceptive tactics precisely because they're so unpopular. So I'm not really scared of the disinfo online any more than I would be scared of getting cut in half if I was the volunteer at a magic show. And so it turns out being able to reveal the magician's tricks, so to speak, is pretty fun work. And so I'm still happy to do it.
Following on from my interview with Phil, I just wanted to add some thoughts on climate disinformation in general. I think it can be quite overwhelming how much information is out there, and now with so much disinformation, it can be quite a task to filter fact from fiction. And then when you add AI to the mix, I think it convolutes things even further. And of course, we have a personal responsibility to consider the source of our information and also how we share it, and to consider how different biases influence our intake of information. But all of this can feel like a lot, and often it's time-consuming to sort through facts. Even with the help of great organisations that are calling for action against disinformation and are assisting with the integrity of climate information, it is still overwhelming and exhausting and at times isolating, which can engender disengagement with climate action. At least this is sort of how I felt a bit when researching the show. So this is why I wanted to consider sort of some different angles as to how we might engage in climate change news and stories in a different way, in a way that is a lot more personal and generative and based on things other than evidence, so we don't always have to struggle to filter the fact from the fiction. And there was this article in Emergence magazine called A Ghost Life by Llewellyn Vaughan Lee, and the article considers how today's digital world is saturated with disinformation and emotional manipulation, which creates a sense of alienation and unreality. And this virtual wasteland disconnects people from community, truth, and the natural world. And drawing on Zen teachings, Vaughan Lee suggests that a potential refuge or antidote might lie in returning to simple, grounded, everyday experiences, like cooking or walking in nature and paying attention to the living world around us. And through this ordinary awareness, we can reconnect with a deeper, more authentic reality beyond the distortions of the online environment. And this article stood out to me because while disinformation seems relatively new or more prominent now in the digital world of AI and social media, the act of being grounded, aware, reflective, and not illusioned is an ancient practice, which sort of supposes that the act of staying connected to truths and to realities is something humans have struggled with or at least considered for a very long time. And I wonder if we can use these ancient teachings and also sort of non-Western, non-capitalist-run media teachings and knowledges in, of course, sort of a non-appropriating and decolonial way to sustain us otherwise. And I think there's such an overload of information, but not really an overload of relational storytelling, as well as trust in embodied knowledge and trust in relationships. And so how can we put more emphasis back into this rather than so much emphasis and, in a way, vulnerability in information and facts and data? And I'm not suggesting we sort of completely remove ourselves or avoid climate news and science, but I am suggesting that when it does become too overwhelming or time-consuming, that we find other ways to attune ourselves to our environment, to our climate, to our ecological awareness, to learn and to educate ourselves on what is happening in our world through other practices that don't involve the consumption and overconsumption of news. And we can definitely find guidance for this in ancient teachings and traditional knowledges. And I think we have to trust ourselves to be able to gain wisdom through attunement and awareness and embodiment, and trust that there are other ways of attaining knowledges like that separate from science and media.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And I was really grateful when Shay shared this article with me. I thought it was super interesting. And I really like it had like this importance of, well, it really highlighted this importance of in-person connection and community and acknowledging your surroundings and how important that is. Because I think remembering where you came from and all that surrounds you really makes you appreciate and understand our need for climate action just that so much more. Because I think sometimes through news and science, which is great, we need to stay informed. But I think that's also so far, like it kind of removes us from where we are and why it's important to us specifically and personally. Thank you so, so much for tuning into the Climate Action Show this Monday night on the Community Broadcast Network. I've been Bella, Shay's also joined us, and also Rosie, which has been great. Thank you so much to all of our guests today. We had quite a lot. We had Christian Downey, co-author of Climate Obstruction, A Global Assessment. And we also had Philip Newell from Climate Action Against Disinformation. And it was really interesting to hear about their viewpoints of big tech, big oil, big business, big ag, and about the funding going on behind the scenes and how they're helping spread misinformation and disinformation when it comes to climate action. I also want to thank all the interviewers that Rosie was able to get through her Vox Pop and Street interview. So thank you once again to all those on the ground of the public housing towers. And thanks again to our interviewees. That was Duff, Captain Kangaroo, Sandra, and Charlotte, our newly 3CR subscriber. If you're interested in subscribing or helping support, that would mean the world. You can always go to www.3cr.org.au and subscribe through there. And you can also go to that link, which I just said, and go to our page. So if you missed anything and you were interested in re-listening to any interviews, a copy of this episode will be placed on our page with the full interviews as well. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next Monday. And bending low.